This episode is brought to you by La Quinta by Wyndham. Your work can take you all over the place, like Texas. You've never been, but it's going to be great because you're staying at La Quinta by Wyndham. Their free bright side breakfast will give you energy for the day ahead. And after, you can unwind using their free high-speed Wi-Fi. Tonight, La Quinta. Tomorrow, you shine. Book your stay today at LQ.com.
At Evernorth Health Services, we believe costs shouldn't get in the way of life-changing care. And we're doing everything in our power to make it possible. Behavioral health solutions that also keep your projections at their best? It's possible. Pharmacy benefits that benefit your bottom line? It's possible. Complex specialty care that cares about your ROI? It's possible. Because we're already doing it. All while saving businesses billions. That's Wonder made possible. Learn more at evernorth.com/wonder.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Families have a lot going on. Let Ollie help manage the mental load with new cognitive health supplements for everyone 4 and up, like delicious Ollie Focus Pops or Ollie Mellow Pops for kids. And for parents, try 3 new Brainy Chews to help you focus, chill out, or get energized. Find these cognitive health buddies for the whole fam at Ollie.com. That's OLLY.com. These statements have not been evaluated by the Food and Drug Administration. This product is not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease.
The following podcast contains explicit language.
Hello, and welcome to the Brexit Fallout edition of Slate Money, your guide to the business and finance news of the Brexit, because we had an entire Brexit edition the day after Brexit happened, but frankly, there's just so much Brexiting going on. We need to return to Brexit. And thank you for all of your emails about the various different podcasts you listen to. I know it turns out that top of the list is the Slate Political Gabfest. Who'd have thunk? So I guess you can all listen to the Slate Political Gabfest for everything you need to know about Michael Gove and Nigel Farage and Andrea Leadsom and all of these loathsome British politicians. So we are going to stick to the financial repercussions of Brexit here because they are enormous and not necessarily or entirely confined to the UK. We're going to talk about what's happening to the Italian banks. They are looking shaky. We are going to talk about interest rates all over the world, in Switzerland and Japan, which are going even more negative than they were before. But first, oh wait, hang on a sec. Who's we?
You never introduced us, Felix.
Who's we? We is...
That's a question these days.
Okay, so the first bit of good news is that Jordan Weissman, the Slate Money Box columnist, has been let out of his cage. Where, like, he was literally just feet away from the Brexit discussion that we had last time round, but was somehow recused himself from participating.
Well, last time, yeah, I was called upon to do my regular job, which was put words on the internet. But I feel like
putting your voice into the podcastosphere is at least as valuable and important as putting words on the internet.
It's much more enjoyable.
I feel a little superior here because I don't have a regular job, so you know.
So we have Jordan Weissman. We also have the woman without a regular job.
That's me.
Kathy O'Neill.
Hi.
But you do have a blog called mathbabe.org.
I do.
And yeah, Kathy, tell us about property funds in the UK.
Yeah, so this is actually a direct continuation of our conversation without Jordan, which was very sad to not have him. But we did have that really wonderful guy.
Leo Carey.
Yeah, he was great.
Leo was great. He used words like phonic.
He was so... you know, articulate. I was really...
Okay, guys.
He had a great English accent.
We love you, though, Jordan.
This is the classic lineup. Okay?
We love Paul Ford. We love Leo Carey.
We love our guests, however.
We love our guests.
We love each other, too. Let's continue.
And Jordan Weissman is not bad in a pinch.
He's wonderful.
Yeah.
So anyway, we talked about the possible repercussions of Brexit on the day after. And one of the things we thought about was finance moving out of the city of London. And what would that mean to real estate prices? And guess what? It means a lot to real estate prices. In the last few days, a bunch of different things called commercial property mutual funds in the UK, which center on basically investing in UK commercial property, like stores and buildings, have announced that they are closing their gates. They're not letting anyone take out their money.
So there's a few of these funds. And basically, as we know, buildings are illiquid assets. And so these funds are traded on the stock market, and they're mutual funds. And you can just say, you look at the price at which the fund closed on any given day and say, I want to buy at that price or sell at that price, you know, bid offer spread notwithstanding. And they have now decided, well, a few of them, like three or four of them at least, have decided, maybe five, have decided that they're not even going to make a market. You just can't sell at any price. Because what's happened to commercial property is that, you know, as Kathy says, well, Kathy says it's gone down in value. The fact is no one knows what's happened to the value of this commercial property because no deals have got done in the UK since the Brexit vote, literally zero. And I was at a conference in London last week, and there was this sort of show of hands of like, who among you has like postponed making a major decision which you would otherwise have made because of Brexit? And like the entire room, all hands just shot up. And this is why Britain is going into a recession, is because a recession is just when economic activity slows down, and economic activity is clearly slowing down because people are just not doing shit for the time being.
Yeah, so there's like a $25 billion commercial property market of this type in the UK, and eight of the funds, which represents more than half the market, have officially frozen transactions on their funds. So nobody can take
one of them, though, has done something a bit more interesting. Aberdeen, I believe it is, has said, yeah, if you want to leave, we'll give you like a super lowball price you can leave at. And so
they mark down by 17%.
By 17%. So if they're like, if you want to take a 17% discount and leave at, you know, a 17% loss, you can do that. And that way they're providing liquidity to people who really want to leave and to people who are scared. But what you can't do is basically just give yourself liquidity at no cost, because the one thing which doesn't exist right now in UK property market is liquidity at no cost. In fact, there's no liquidity basically at all.
So I first have a question and then I have a comment. The question is, do you think it's fair to basically just look at these funds now going forward is kind of like fear indexes for the state of the, you know, of London's financial market or London's financial sector? I mean, is this going to be the kind of thing where you can just look at these funds and say, okay, this is where people think the winds are blowing? Or
no, I mean, the financial sector is the banks.
Yeah.
And you can look at the share price of Barclays as a good fear index for London's financial sector. And I think that's a much better index. Frankly, the pound is a much better index than looking to see whether a bunch of commercial real estate funds are open or closed. I think this is basically a sign that we are in a very abnormal time.
Okay.
Because the last time we can all remember funds closing was, you know, Soc Gen and Bear Stearns at the end of 2007, at the beginning of, you know, the credit crisis. And that was a harbinger, as we know, of much, much worse things to come.
And thanks for bringing that up, because it did happen in 2008, this very same kind of thing. And in fact, D.E. Shaw closed their gates in 2008. But one thing I remember is that near the beginning of the financial crisis, a friend of mine who's a quantitative hedge fund guy, like, estimated what the markets were saying if you pretended like everything was normal and you were just saying, what does the market think that the housing prices are going to be in 3 years? Because there's various ways to look. And it ended up being relatively accurate 3 years later, which is to say, like, people when there's something going on in the market, there's like a crisis, a panic, they always say, oh, close the gates. We don't want to sell for fire sales. We don't want to like lose too much money. But I think part of it is just that they don't want to admit that things are worth a lot less than they want them to be worth.
Yeah.
So it's, in some sense, it's just like postponing bad news.
Well, maybe it's postponing bad news, but on the other hand, it makes sense, because if a property fund has a lot of redemptions, the only way it can meet those redemptions is by selling property.
Yes.
you can't sell property. No one benefits if you sell property in a fire sale. And you couldn't anyway. Like, there are no sort of fire sale buyers of London property right now. Everyone is waiting to see.
Here's like just devil's advocate on that. There's going to be someone who's going to buy it if the price is low enough, right? People are just not willing to put the price low enough for those buyers, right? That's what it really is.
Now, I feel like that's generally true in the securities market, but in the commercial property market, it's less true. I feel like the commercial property market is an incredibly illiquid market at the best of times, that even in a booming market where everyone is super bullish, you can't do a fire sale. The sales of commercial property take sometimes years to negotiate, even in the best of times. And the idea that you can just sort of say, oh, well, I'll take a discount and, you know, sell more quickly, I don't think it works like that.
Well, I'm not saying it works perfectly like that. I'm just saying that this notion that we literally there are no buyers out there and we can't possibly sell is just a little bit of a fabrication.
It's an empirical fact.
It's certainly true. Selling a building does take a lot. I mean, it does take time. This was, you know, the industry my dad was in. Like, it just takes a long time.
It does take a long time. And it's a weird market.
It's not instantaneous.
It's a sticky market. And these funds are definitely like facing a completely unexpected situation where they had 20%, many of them had 20% cash on hand. So that meant if like 20% of the people wanted their money back, they could just literally hand them cash. But the other 80% was actually invested in actual commercial real estate. So when 40% of people wanted their money back immediately, suddenly they're like, screw this, we can't actually do this.
Well, it's not, you don't even need, it doesn't even need to be 40%. It's just that if it makes sense to have 20% cash, it doesn't make sense to give all of that cash to exiting unit holders and have no cash left on hand. A lot of these commercial property funds, I'm sure, are looking to use some of that cash to start buying property at lower prices, you know, but at the time, for the time, if they give all of their cash to departing unit holders, they can't do that. It makes sense if you are offering an exposure to a fundamentally illiquid asset class that at times like this, you basically suspend the fiction that the investment is liquid. That makes sense to me.
I mean, it's part of the contract. So people sign up for that when they invest in this.
I just want to also come back to the observation I was going to try to make before, which is slightly tangential, but I think important, which is that, you know, what we're seeing right now with these property funds and across Britain is a response to, like you said, uncertainty. Like, we really do not know what's going to happen. And to me, that brings back memories actually of the US in the early Obama years, where you would hear politicians talking about, oh, President Obama, the Democrats are creating uncertainty by, you know, passing Obamacare or by proposing to raise taxes. And it was always kind of fuzzy. And I think that you're getting actually a really clear illustration of first, the fact that uncertainty really can be damaging, but what uncertainty actually looks like, where there's a paralyzing fear of we do not know what the whole system is going to be anymore. It's not just a matter of, oh, we might pay a little bit more taxes or we might have to give healthcare or not. It's we do not know how our economy is based, what the rules of the economy are going to be.
And this is what Paul Krugman has been, you know, sort of twisting himself up in knots about when it comes to Brexit, is that Krugman is famously scathing about these things called confidence fairies, where he's like, you know, everyone was talking, as you say, Jordan, during the early Obama years about, oh, well, confidence is going to evaporate and that's going to be bad for the economy. And of course, it didn't work out that way at all. And Krugman was right that these confidence fairies didn't exist really in 2009, 2010. And so now he's being a little bit skeptical about the existence of confidence fairies in the UK. But I think in the UK, you're absolutely right. They do exist. They are real. We're seeing them in the way that people are trying to get out of their exposure to commercial property and not being able to. We're seeing them in the value of the pound. We're seeing them in the fact that Britain is almost certainly going to have a recession. And we're seeing them, frankly, I mean, we're not going to spend too much time talking about British politics, but we're seeing them in the fact that there is no leadership in Britain anymore. Like, you know, there's no one in charge. And that's just, you know, that can't be good for the country. So
No one in charge better than Boris Johnson in charge, though?
Boris Johnson would have actually, he was the Brexiteer. He was the leave guy who was most likely to not leave and that's to just true. Leave things in limbo.
Can I just make one comment about confidence fairies, though? Because I heard a lot about confidence fairies working in finance during the crisis. And I always got annoyed by the concept of a confidence fairy because it seemed like people used that concept as if all we needed was confidence. Like the underlyings were all good and we would go back to normal. Well, and fuck that. Like this is not normal. It's going to be different.
You're absolutely right, Kathy. This is bad in the UK. It's not just a question of confidence, although confidence is certainly making things worse.
Apple Card is the perfect cash back rewards credit card. You earn up to 3% daily cash on every purchase every day. That's 3% on your favorite products at Apple, 2% on all other Apple Card with Apple Pay purchases, and 1% on anything you buy with your titanium Apple Card or virtual card number. Visit apple.co/cardcalculator to see how much you can earn. Apple Card issued by Goldman Sachs Bank USA, Salt Lake City branch. Subject to credit approval. Terms apply.
So let's pick up this conversation about confidence and fear with my favorite fear index, which is the price of government bonds. When people are afraid, you get this thing called flight to quality. And you want very safe bonds without any credit risk. And you want bonds in very safe currencies, which you think aren't going to implode like the pound just did. So what that means in practice, it turns out, means that you wind up buying bonds in euros and dollars and Japanese yen and Swiss francs, and you pay whatever it takes. And then on top of that, what you see is a bunch of bond traders who are seeing which way the wind is blowing. And I have one of my favorite stats about the bond market is that if you look at government bonds over 2016, if you just invested in government bonds at the beginning of the year, right now you're sitting on a 25% annualized
Jesus
gain.
Christ.
So bond traders are just making huge amounts of money by going long government bonds, no matter what the yield. And so where we are now is this situation where there are $13 billion of bonds with negative yields. People get very excited about negative yields. Because zero is an important number. But like, it's symptomatic of those two things. Number one is fear, and number two is just momentum trading, because you can make money on bonds with negative yields by buying them expensive and then selling them even more expensive to a greater fool.
Can I just, I just want to go back up one second. Like, why do people put money into bonds when they're afraid?
Yeah.
And I think, I mean, tell me if you disagree, but my theory is that it's because mostly people ride the stock market, and the stock market goes up a lot of the time. But then when stock markets go down, the bond market goes up. Like they're anti-correlated. So if you are like very long in the stock market, you're like, oh shit, we have no idea what's going to happen in the world economy. The stocks might really drop down. So I'm going to hedge by getting a bunch of bonds that might go up.
Well,
in
bonds
those
have
situations.
A guaranteed return of capital. Like, you know,
that's the other thing.
They might have a negative yield, so you might get back a little bit less than you invested, but ultimately you will get back your money. And if you're investing in a foreign currency like Swiss francs or Japanese yen, if that currency goes up, then you make money regardless of the negative yield. So it's inherently just a much safer place to put your money than the stock market, where you can lose everything.
I mean, there's another aspect to this, which is a little bit scary, which is that if you think there's deflation coming, right? If you think prices are going to fall in a country, you can actually also make money off of a negative yield.
Because how do you make money?
Because you're in real terms, you're making money because of deflation.
You can make money in real terms.
Exactly.
Right. So that's the other thing, is that you have to differentiate between nominal prices and real prices. And economists like Jordan love to talk about real prices. Yeah. And they're like, well, if your money went down, but the cost of goods went down even more, then really you made money, which is an argument which only an economist could really love.
That's 10%, and that's how we look at bond
market. But actually, it's not such a bad argument. Like, according to anybody I've read recently, there's no expectation of a strong inflation, at the very least. And there's some fear, real fear of deflation.
Yeah, exactly. That's how a lot of macro people are looking at the state of the bond market. That's a sign that people just don't think inflation – I mean – don't think inflation is coming anytime soon. Deflation could be coming. To give you a sense of the timeline we're looking at, the piece of news that everyone kind of latched onto late last week and this week was that all of Switzerland's bonds went negative, all the way out to 50 years. You literally have to pay to lend money Switzerland for 50 years at a time now.
That's not necessarily like a strong vote in favor of deflation into the Swiss franc.
No, but
it's a combination.
I want to make one distinction, which I think I've made on this show before, but it's an important one, is that people elide the two slightly different things. There's an important difference between, number one, the yield on the bond.
Yeah.
And number two, how much Switzerland is borrowing, how much Switzerland is paying to borrow money. And so when Jordan is saying that you're paying to lend money to Switzerland, that's not true. What you're paying for is an asset, a bond, which is owned by someone else. And the person you're paying is the previous holder of the bond. It is not a loan to Switzerland, but the Switzerland loan borrowed the money at whatever interest rate ages ago. The vast majority, for all the 29% of government bonds out there are trading at negative yields, almost none of them were issued at negative yields.
Yeah, but I mean, countries like Germany are issuing bonds at negative yields. I mean, there are countries now
issuing notes. They're issuing very short-term debt at negative yields. Switzerland issued one 10-year bond at a negative yield of minus 0.055%. Japan has issued one, I think, proper long-term bond. But what we're talking about is a tiny fraction of all of the negative. It's actually been issued.
The contracts themselves are the things that are being bought and sold.
You're buying the security because it's gone up in price, and so the yield goes down. But I'm just saying these countries literally are actually now issuing these bonds at negative yields, and I'm sure that's going to happen more in the future given where we are now.
And that's true. And the one interesting thing I'll note is that this 10-year bond, which was issued at a yield of minus 0.055%, still was issued with a 1.5% coupon. It had a nice, like, relatively hefty 1.5% coupon, which you get every year. You just the price you're paying for that bond up front is so high that even with all of those coupons, you won't get all of your money back. I'm just going to throw in another couple of numbers here because I love numbers, and this is a number podcast. One is that there have been 659 rate cuts since the Lehman crisis around the world.
Wow.
That's a lot of rate cuts.
What does that say about the world economy?
And this is ultimately the real reason why there are so many negative yielding bonds. It's just because we live in a world of zero interest rates. And when we're talking about negative, we're just talking about, you know, a third of the bonds at zero interest rates are below zero and two-thirds are above zero, and it averages out to slightly above zero, but we're in a zero.
So the entire world is becoming Japan.
Yeah, that's my friend Matt's favorite thing to say. The whole world is turning Japanese.
Because Japan started this 20 years before anyone else.
The problem is also it's self-reinforcing. When bonds everywhere around the world go to zero, it in turn becomes incredibly hard for a central bank to raise rates because if, say, the Fed wants to raise interest rates, everyone's going to flood into treasury bonds, dollar-denominated assets. All of a sudden, the U.S. dollar is going to go up, and that's really bad for our economy. It can push us into deflation.
Strong dollar is in the national interest. Haven't you heard every single Treasury Secretary for the past 50 years? But we're not going to get into that.
That's actually interesting.
Other little data point which I want to throw in here is about the high-yield leveraged loan market. Larry Summers, our favorite person, wrote a column this week about how when his parents had a 4.5% mortgage, he would look on that and go, wow, those were some halcyon days we will never see again. The opposite of a safe borrowing mortgage is this thing called leveraged loans, which is super high risk loans with massive credit risk embedded. Uber, our favorite company, just came to market with $1.15 billion of leveraged loans, high yield loans. What was the coupon? What was the yield on these things? 5%.
Wow.
That's what counts as high yield these
days. People are so desperate.
It's 5%. Okay.
Plus, people love Uber. It's like its own thing.
But not, I mean, it doesn't matter how much you love it. Like, you're still only getting 5%.
It's like owning a piece of the Green Bay Packers.
Yeah, it's like owning a seat from Yankee Stadium.
All right. On which note?
Hello, I'm Imi Harper. On the slow newscast from Tortoise, I tell the story of how a Hong Kong billionaire was silenced.
I got bombs thrown into my house. I got people came here, ransacked my computer. And I got people fractured me. I got this and that, but I'm safe.
And what it reveals about the freedoms Hong Kong no longer enjoys. Listen to Hong Kong's Rebel Billionaire on the slow newscast, wherever you get your podcasts.
We should tie all of this up, Jordan, with, I think, the classic case of, like, confidence and illiquidity and zero interest rates all sort of conspiring to create what I believe is known as an omni-shambles.
It's an omni. I wonder what the Italian word for that is.
What is the Italian word for omni-shambles?
Listeners, we are relying on you.
Yeah, please let us know if any of you are fluent in Italian. So, yeah, Italy's banks are not looking too good, and it's sort of that their problems kind of combine all the things we've just been discussing. Specifically, people are starting to freak out that about 17% of the loans on their books have gone bad, are sour. Italy's banks are not in a good place financially, and it's gotten to the point, and that's being kind of reinforced now by Brexit. That's kind of creating more fear, more panic about what's going to happen in Europe, and of course in Italy too, everywhere around Europe.
What's that 17% compared to, like, what we saw in the U.S. during the financial crisis?
It's like 10 times or something. I mean,
I thought it was more like 3 times, but it was a lot worse.
I think it's 10 times like what's normal in the U.S. now. Okay.
Well, I mean, but to these comparisons are dangerous to make. Italian banks and Italy in general is much more built on small and medium-sized enterprises which borrow money, much less built on financial markets and loan markets and bond markets. The problem with the Italian banks is that there is no secondary market for loans. The banks, what they do is they make these loans and then they sit on them to maturity. Any bank in any country at the low point of a credit cycle, if you force it to markets, loans to market, is going to look pretty insolvent. And also it has to be said that no one is saying that the Italian banks are insolvent. They're saying that their capital ratios are low, but they're still solvent. And indeed, even the worst ones, like, you know, that ancient bank in Siena, is still profitable. It's still making money. But people are worried because their capital ratios are too low. And historically, the Italian bankers had and they have seen this a million times. This is Italy. This is not exactly the world's most stable country. Italian bankers have seen this a million times. What they do is they just sit on their loans until, you know, the credit cycle comes out the other side, and then everything's fine. The problem is that under European banking regulations, they need to start marking all of these bad loans to market, and they need to worry about their solvency, and they need to recapitalize themselves, and no one has any interest in recapitalizing them.
Yeah, so Italy's very good-looking Prime Minister Matteo Renzi essentially wanted to give them a bailout, wanted to give them approximately 40 billion euro influx of capital. And Europe looked at this and said no, that this would violate our new anti-bailout rules that went in place in 2014. And the idea is that the conflict is that Europe's rules say that if you're going to do any kind of attempt to save the bank, equity holders have to take some kind of losses. You have to force losses on the owners of the bank, and the people who own the bank's debts. And the problem in Italy with that is that a lot of the bondholders of these banks' debts are retail investors, which is really unusual. It's kind of a symptom of Italy's mom and pop economy, that the people who own bank debt for whatever reason are random retirees.
Let's be clear about this. Normal mom-and-pop people own bank debt, again, in every country in the world. They're called depositors. So the difference between Italian banks and other banks in other places is that depositors are treated differently. They are sort of bail-inable bondholders, basically. If you have a bank CD, which is a big thing in Italy, then you're a bail-inable bondholder rather than a depositor who's protected. And so there are huge riots anytime anyone wants to bail in bondholders of Italian banks. So I feel like this is going to get solved, that there is going to be an Italian government bailout and that the Europeans are going to hold their nose and allow it, just because the Italian banking system is so unlike, you know, the Dutch banking system or the German banking system, that the laws which were passed to deal with those banking systems just don't really apply very well to Italy.
Yeah, I mean, this is, I guess, coming back to the kind of contradictions inherent in the EU, right? Like, they're trying to move towards banking union and, you know, along with monetary union. And that's really hard when you have national banking systems that don't mesh, that don't fundamentally work the same ways. Unless, you know, this wouldn't be a problem in the U.S. when you're, if you're comparing banks in New York and Mississippi necessarily.
So why did Italy agree to those rules?
That's a good question. They're 2014 rules. They probably didn't have a lot of say, is my guess.
It's yeah.
So the people whose systems worked with these rules decided.
Well, I mean,
on
like,
rules.
It doesn't. There's no such thing as a system which works with the rules. But the idea in general is that bondholders should be bailed in. And in principle, everyone is in favor of this idea. That if you're going to bail out banks, yeah, you hit the stockholders, but you should also hit some of the. What's known as loss-absorbing capital, and that the bondholders should be counted among loss-absorbing capital. The problem is that the smaller the bondholders get, the less capacity those people have to absorb losses.
Yeah, and I mean this is – it's a – to give you a sense, like there are stories in Italy about people committing suicide because they were bailed in when a bank was bailed out.
Can we go back to the 17% losses? Does this mean like that the actual economy of Italy is sucking, and like is it going to get worse?
I mean, Italy's economy is not well.
It's not 17% losses. It's 17% non-performing loans.
Okay.
And who knows what the value of those non-performing loans is.
I mean, but you mentioned
We know it's not zero. The Italian banks are valuing their non-performing loans at about 43 cents on the dollar. If they try and sell them, they're being offered about 20 cents on the dollar. So that's why they're not selling them. Honestly, I feel like 43 cents is probably not a bad valuation for them, that most of them are collateralized by some kind of property or other. And here we get back to the whole question of, you know, the UK property market and stuff like that. You know, there is a collateral. There are businesses here. Eventually, the businesses will probably turn around. Some of them will start being able to repay those debts. It's not like just because these loans are not performing that they will never perform.
Yeah, but when you talk about like waiting out the credit cycle, it sort of gives you the impression that like there's like a sine wave and you're at the hump and it's going to come back down and we're going to be okay. I'm just wondering if we have that reason to think that this is going to end anytime soon.
I mean, for Italy, I don't think there's any. So, I mean, their unemployment rate, last I looked, was still in the teens. Their economy has not substantially rebounded from
and
the
crisis. Is this like the first of many? Is this like Portugal and Spain? Are there
people are worried about that?
Yeah,
we've already had a major bank failure in Portugal. So yeah, that Southern European banks have been in crisis for 5 years now, and we've had a system of rolling bailouts. And one of the reasons for these 2014 rules was precisely that the European Union got sick of all of these government bailouts and said, stop bailing out your banks because it's screwing up our internal EU finances in ways that the Germans don't like. But ultimately, when a country's banks get into trouble, that country does need to bail out the banks. You know, we discovered that in the US in 2008. We discovered that in Spain in 2011. We discovered that in Greece in 2012. Like, we've discovered that in so many countries. When push comes to shove, these banks are going to have to get bailed out. It's just part of how a modern economy works.
Yeah, it just half measures. You know, kind of kicking the can, half bailing them out, sort of saying, okay, well, you know, these banks are okay now, but Italy's are sort of teetering, but we'll let them try to handle it for a while. It doesn't work. I mean, the U.S., the bailout was pretty swift and, you know, was done with overpowering force, and that's why the banks recovered as quickly as they did. So, you know, I think you're seeing Europe's hesitancy come back to haunt it.
And the other thing that's really important to mention is precisely because there's much less of a securities market in Italy, the economy, which should come back, will only come back if the banks are lending. So if the banks are spending all of their profits recapitalizing themselves and paying back bailout loans instead of actually lending to small and medium-sized businesses, which is what they exist to do, then that's just going to make the Italian economy worse. And this is true in all of Europe, that if you look at bank stock prices in Europe, across Europe, not just in Italy, but in Germany and Holland and France and Spain, they've been plunging since Brexit. And there is an unbelievably strong correlation between bank stock prices and the amount that they lend like a year right. later. So if that happens this time and the lending goes down in line with the stock prices, that basically means that all of Europe is going to have a Brexit-induced recession, not just the UK.
For God's sakes, this is incredibly depressing.
The third European recession in a decade.
But I mean, it really sounds like the real problem here is the economy. The banking system absolutely needs to be healthy to revive an economy. And there are these silly rules that are preventing what needs to happen from happening. If these rules really get in the way of everything, like this is going
to
be terrible.
And just to close the circle on the way all of these things are connected, we have zero interest rates in Europe, which means that the cost to the governments of borrowing the money to bail out the banks is zero.
Germany.
So it's just like a principle.
I've been saying that Germany should literally just be borrowing money and like rocketing bonobos into space, just like spending it however they can at this point.
Bonobos do not deserve that.
Anything, whatever. They just burn money however you can.
Well, how about you give it to the Italian small and medium businesses that need it?
Universal basic income.
Yeah, anything.
Yes.
Anything that might get the economy going at this point, they are being paid, Germany specifically and Switzerland now, it seems, are being paid to borrow and try to save the world. And
I feel like the EU really has to go down. Sorry. I mean, I know we're...
Kathy's a Brexiteer. She's a secret leader.
I really think...
Are you a believer?
I really think that they need to adjust their thinking. If they want to be attractive to their members. They can't just be attractive to Germany and
the Netherlands. Here's the thing I'm a little surprised about here, because bailing in bondholders is the kind of thing that I would think you would be a fan of, because it is sort of creating, you know, it should create a little bit more moral hazard. It should try to make the banking system a little bit safer, if anything, or less risky. That's the idea behind it, partly. So I think
people who like are just, you know, oh, I'm speculating on this bank low, like I'm going to lend my money to this bank because I think it's going to get bailed out. That's not a great thing, right? But it's also not a great thing to starve a country of the basic investments that banking systems do things. I'm not a nihilist.
And when you look at bank bonds in virtually all countries in the world, it's people, you know, sophisticated institutional investors making calculations of credit risk and saying, well, there's a certain risk of default and we're going to charge this much extra yield in order to make up for it. In Italy, it's like, I'm putting my money in the bank. Yeah. It's not that kind of thinking. It's a different investor base.
Hi, this is Dahlia Lithwick, host of Slate's legal podcast, Amicus. If you're listening to this show, you might be interested in Amicus's live show that we're hosting in Washington, D.C. on Tuesday, May the 14th. My colleague, Mark Joseph Stern, and I will be talking to some amazing guests, including Sherrilyn Ifill and a sitting state Supreme Court justice, all about how originalism, a relatively recently invented way of interpreting the Constitution, has taken over the Supreme Court and radically reshaped the law. It's been doctrinal rocket fuel for the conservative legal movement and facilitated the rolling back of abortion rights, the expansion of gun rights, and the obliteration of the separation of church and state. And as another wildly consequential Supreme Court term careers to its end, the court's originalists are on a tear. But there's something you can do about it, and we hope you'll join us in D.C. on May 14th to explore the possible pathways out of the current situation. Go to slate.com/amicuslive for tickets.
Okay, numbers round.
I have a number. It's two. It's very simple.
Oh, no. I think you took my number.
Oh, shit. That's why I said it first. It's the number of years.
Ah, oh, God damn it, Kathy.
That Elizabeth Holmes is not allowed to own a medical facility.
Yeah.
A blood testing facility.
Yeah, they've slaughtered this unicorn.
Oh, my God. I have to say, it's like pretty satisfying to someone who actually cares about science. And we've talked about this many times. But Elizabeth Holmes was like basically just pretending that she had invented a new kind of blood test. They did 81. They finally did like this criminal investigation. They did 81 tests, patient result tests. All of them were inaccurate.
81 of 81.
It was like 0% accuracy.
Like statistically speaking, you would think that just randomly one or two would be correct.
Yes.
You
know? 81 out of 81 were wrong. And I'm like, yes, shut that stuff down right now.
I mean, yeah, the punishment, like there was more. Like that was only the beginning of Theranos' punishment. It was like,
do you have another number coming up into it?
Jordan, come up with another number.
This is the first time this has ever happened, people.
We've managed to fudge it before. My number is 276,000, which is it's a jobs report number. So this month, the U.S. economy gained 287,000 jobs. The previous month, the U.S. economy gained 11,000 jobs.
Not good.
So my point is that 11,000 is a low number, which is bad, and 287,000 is a high number, which is good. But my bigger point is that what we are finally seeing is the kind of natural randomness in data series that you should be that we should expect in all natural data series, and we shouldn't get alarmed by, and that this kind of large fluctuation is what I kind of feel the jobs report series should do, and for many, many years has not been doing. It's been suspiciously steady month to month, given the margin of error on the numbers, which is plus or minus like 150,000.
Is it really that big?
Yeah,
that
it's huge. It's that big.
That's why you should never, ever trust like the first, the one that comes out on that Friday. Don't trust it until the report.
I mean, they do seasonal adjustment, so that makes it a little smoother. But yeah, you're right. If the error bars are that big.
If the error bars are that big, you would not expect the numbers to be as smooth as they are. And so now, finally, maybe just randomly, we are seeing the kind of month-to-month fluctuation, which just goes to prove that, you know, stochastic data series are stochastic.
That's so sweet.
Jesus. So, you know what? I'm just going to go with since my number was viciously taken away from me.
You got to go first, man.
I'm just going to go. Yeah, right. I'm just going to go with 3 as my number. And going off of Felix, if you are interested in following the jobs report, my preferred measure is always to look at the 3-month rolling average on jobs, because that just gives you a slightly more realistic sense of the longer or the midterm trend, which is what people are really interested in. So 3.
It's always a balance between smoothness and timeliness.
That is very true. But I feel the rolling average is usually a little bit more indicative of what's going on.
I have a side gig, an unpaid side gig as a weight loss coach.
Oh, you do?
To a guy with a former guest of Slate Money, actually, who I shall not name, who has a withing scale, one of his lovely withing scales. And the thing I love about withing
is it the brand withing?
It's like Wi-Fi connected bathroom scale.
You've mentioned you've rhapsodized about this before on the show.
And the reason I like the withing's Wi-Fi connected bathroom scale is that it encourages you to ignore a lot of that stochastic randomness in data series, and it will show you your long-term moving average, which is a much better indication of how well, you know, what's happening to your weight over time, rather than standing on the scale and getting a single data point.
Yeah.
I have a feeling some people are going to call in and ask you to be their life coach / weight loss coach.
I don't know.
Yeah, don't do that. Don't do that. Do write in. The email address is slatemoney@slate.com. Don't ask me to be your weight loss coach, because honestly, I'm not very good at that. But yeah, give us whatever feedback. Thank you for all of your feedback, by the way, on last week's religion episode. It turns out a lot of you are theologically sophisticated. Who knew? So that was good to learn. And come back next week. I have some sad news.
What? Oh, yeah.
Yeah. Moment of silence.
This was the very last Slate Money to be produced by the one and only Audrey Quinn.
Audrey, we'll miss you.
Audrey, we will miss you. Thank you very much to Audrey for producing this week and for countless weeks in the past. You've been amazing. Thank you too to the executive producers who do much less work. They are Steve Lickteig and Andy Bowers. That is, they have names. This is what we know about them. They run this thing called Panoply. You can check out all of the Panoply podcasts at itunes.com/panoply. Find us in iTunes, leave reviews there, and we will talk to you next week on Slate Money.